Hello, my name is Peter. Welcome to this week's edition of Connecticut Connections, a quick review of some of this week's top news stories from around our state. Our first article was published in the Hartford Courant on March 26th. It's written by Ed Stenard, and it's titled, Connecticut Health Center Claims Rogue Board Takeover. A takeover of the board of Charter Oak Health Center by several employees threatens the health care of vulnerable Connecticut residents, according to claims by the former board president in a lawsuit against its current board. Adrian Wood, who left as president in November 2023, after serving on the board for 10 years, is suing three current board members. Other plaintiffs include Charter Oak Health Center, Inc., and four other ousted board members, Joel Cruz, Martin John, Eileen Alvarado, and Leslie Arroyo. They are suing three other board members, Veronica Barcelona, Claudius McNish, and Lolita Young. Barcelona is listed as chairperson of the board of the Charter Oaks website. McNish and Young are listed as board members. Attempts to reach the defendants in the lawsuit were unsuccessful. The suit was recently filed in the Superior Court of Hartford. According to the lawsuit, former board members claim they were sent letters saying they had served beyond their terms, their email accounts were shut down, and they were locked out of the building. There has been a coup. The disgruntled employees have taken over the institution, period, said Robert Simpson, an attorney with Shook, Hardy, and Bacon of Hartford, who was representing Charter Oak. The lawsuit is trying to restore law and order. The board, the duly constituted and legal board, was thrown out as a practical matter, and the only way to bring about law and order is to have the courts address this issue to reinstate the board members that were improperly thrown out. Simpson said staff members took over the board, which violates corporate governance. You have employees of an organization who report to the president, the CEO, and the president CEO then reports to the board. This is corporate law 101. Under no circumstances should employees of an organization overthrow the board. That's outrageous, ridiculous, absurd. Charter Oak is a federally qualified health center which receives federal funds and others medical care to underserved population regardless of the ability to pay. Wood said the plaintiffs are suing to preserve the reputation of Charter Oak among the patients it serves. One of my major concerns is what this means for the quality of health care that we provide for a very vulnerable population, and to see all this kind of turmoil and all these things that are happening as a result of actions of certain people, we call into question what kind of impact that will have on people that are oftentimes very uncomfortable going to receive medical attention. The suit's complaint cites a rogue faction of senior staff and board members that allegedly both unlawfully terminated the interim CEO, a former CEO who was serving as a consultant, and others, in which they attempted to install an illegally appointed interim CEO and chairperson of the board. Wood said another key issue is that the new board's actions begin to set a precedent around what employees can do when they get dissatisfied. There's never been a case whereby employees get to have any voice in regards to making decisions about board access. Employees can be unhappy with the board members. That's their right. They don't get to interfere with board activities. They don't get to call board members and have conversations with board members. According to the suit's claims, this rogue faction of senior staff has restricted the duly elected board members' access to Charter Oak facilities, business records, financial transactions, and information systems such as email accounts, in information technology systems, rendering it essentially impossible proper oversight of the Charter Oak by its duly elected and appointed board. It states that among its services, Charter Oak provides medical, dental, and behavioral and crisis intervention services to persons experiencing homelessness in Hartford through its Health Care for the Homeless program. Sadly, these unlawful actions by rogue senior staff places this program and the myriad of others like it administered by Charter Oak at imminent and potentially irreversible risk of harm. According to the lawsuit, as of November 20th, 2023, the board was composed of Wood as chairman, Cruz as vice chairman, Alvarado as secretary, John as treasurer, and members Arroyo, Barcelona, McNish, Young, and Jolynn Hardy, who had recently joined the board. Nichelle Mullins stepped down as CEO on September 26, 2023, but continued as a consultant in order to complete ongoing projects. Dr. Thomas Maynor II was hired as an interim CEO beginning October 11th. During a November 15th board meeting, Rick Markello, then interim CFO and now interim CEO, allegedly and repeatedly expressed that, in his view, some board members were beyond the term limit set forth in the Charter Oak bylaws and could not serve as board members according to the suit. Then, on November 21st, Kimberly Evans, General Counsel, Vice President, and Chief of Compliance and Legal Affairs, allegedly began to essentially fire the Charter Oak Board, emailing members with letters saying that they had extended and exceeded their term limits. Maynor had previously expressed concern about certain job performances, according to the complaint. Evans called Hardy and asked her to participate in a shadow board meeting to elect a new CEO. Hardy refused and let the duly elected board members know, who then offered Maynor a permanent position and suspended Marcello Evans and Timothy Powers, Vice President of Corporate Compliance. The board also removed board members' term limits from Charter Oak's bylaws. The board recognized the issue with respect to term limits, Simpson said. The board, over the course of the years, have identified there have been additional board members and board members have come and gone. This is a vital organization to the city of Hartford. It serves a well-needed underserved population. You can't just turn over the reins of the board to anyone. So identifying board members who have the time, have the commitment, is not necessarily an easy process. He said the same people who raised the issue of term limits are the same individuals whose jobs are threatened. Now, is that a coincidence that they're raising the issue of board and term limits now? Or is it because they recognize that their employment within the organization is in jeopardy? Respectively, I would say it's the latter. On November 22nd, Marcello sent an email to all staff about organizational changes and stating that the board consisted of Barcelona, Young, McNish, and Hardy, with new board members to be added. The lawsuit also states the plaintiffs are not aware whether Charter Oak has a treasurer and expresses their concern about Marcello's decisions. The complaint also calls into question whether negotiations to buy the building next door at 15 Grand Street will be endangered. The deal is close to being finalized, subject to some final negotiations on key business terms. The person most knowledgeable about this project and who had been working on this project for over a year was Nichelle Mullins, whose consulting contract was terminated by the rogue board members. Without the right leadership in place, this important transaction may be in jeopardy, or at a minimum, delayed even longer than it already has. Simpson and Mullins were not paid for at least part of her work as a contractor. It also states that Charter Oak is waiting for a decision from the State Department of Social Services regarding its request for Medicaid rate increase. Once Charter Oak receives a response, it may need to proceed with an appeal. Regardless, this project is of paramount importance as the reimbursement rates Charter Oak receives have a direct impact on the service and staffing levels at Charter Oak. Charter Oak must have the appropriate and timely board and executive leadership ready and working on this project at all times. The complaint also states that a payment to Mullins to be deposited into her retirement account allegedly was canceled by Marcello and the rogue members of the board. This action has exposed Charter Oak to potential liability. The suit asks that Wood, Cruz, Alvarado, John, and Arroyo be declared duly elected members of the board and that all actions taken by the defendants since November 15, 2023 be declared unlawful, void, or beyond their legal power. It also states that the plaintiffs receive an accounting of Charter Oak's finances, that their correspondence, access to buildings and information systems be restored. It's not about me just ever being back on the board, Wood said, because even if I walk away from this situation, I still have the same position in that board. Governance is not something that employees are allowed to do. Now, if I get back on the board or if I continue to serve as a board member, that position still isn't going to change. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on March 25th. It's written by Ed Stenard, and it's titled, Backups Happen Daily Where Three Connecticut Highways Merge. The Connecticut interchange of three major highways has become a headache for drivers who expect daily backups as they head to and from work or even during midday. Those long lines of cars on Interstate 91 in Meriden may not ease soon, but the major project to realign Interstate 91 northbound, Interstate 691, and Route 15, which plays a part in the slowdowns, is well underway. Ultimately, come 2029, when everything is wrapped up and out of here, that's going to be a much different flow of traffic than people have been used to for the last 40 to 50 years, said Josh Morgan, spokesman for the State Department of Transportation. Now, phase two of the project is focusing on eliminating exit 17 on I-91 northbound. Once it's finished in 2028, drivers will get to I-691 and Route 15 via exit 16. The exit ramps aren't long enough, so traffic backs up on the highway from exit 17, Morgan said. a lot of rear-end crashes, sideswipe-type crashes. It's been a long, played, congested interchange, really. There's just too many cars. It just wasn't built to handle the volume that's out there today, so we're going to try to alleviate that. While exit 17 will be shut down, the exit 16 ramp will be widened to two lanes, and a merge to Route 15 will be created. It's confusing out there. A lot of roads are intersecting a lot of volume. So if you go out there mornings, afternoons, it's just as backed up, just too much volume. So what they'll do is actually widen the exit 16 ramp. So instead of a single lane exit, we'll make it a two lane exit to get more vehicles off of the highway, then safely onto the exit ramp. That merge will be onto the right side of Route 15, the traditional entry to a highway. Now vehicles merge from I-91 to the left side of Route 15, Morgan said. Right now, if you head up 91, you get off exit 17, and then you go to merge on Route 15, you are coming onto the highway from the left-hand side, having to merge into the fast lane. That ramp's going to be closed. The new exit 16 is going to be a two-lane ramp, so that exit will allow you to merge onto exit 15, entering the highway in a more traditional manner. Another exit that will be closed is Route 15 northbound, exit 67 to East Main Street. Morgan said the design decisions are driven at the high level by how do you accommodate the 260,000 vehicles that are in traveling in and around these highways every day. One of the issues is we have too many exits on our highways, too many entry points, and then they're not long enough, so people have to merge. And they have to either slam on the brakes or maybe make an unsafe decision of how they're going to merge. By eliminating this exit 67, that allows the room to have that wider exit 16 off 91 to ultimately and hopefully improve that traffic flow. Other improvements include widening the exit 68 west ramp from Route 15 to I-691 westbound, creating a new two-lane exit ramp from Route 15 northbound to I-91 northbound to reduce traffic congestion on the exit 68 northeast ramp, replacing, rehabilitating, or reconfiguring several bridges and adding sound barrier walls in several places. Phase 1, which began at the beginning of the year, is much less ambitious than Phase 2 and 3. It includes realigning and widening the exit 1A, old exit 11 ramp from I-691 eastbound to I-91 northbound to two lanes, adding a lane on I-91 where there is an uphill grade that causes congestion, and replacing a bridge. Phase 3 will include a new two-lane exit ramp from Route 15 southbound to I-91 southbound to reduce congestion on the exit 67 ramp, a new two-lane I-91 southbound ramp to Route 15 southbound to reduce traffic congestion on the exit 17 ramp, a wider two-lane exit 10 ramp from I-691 eastbound to Route 15 southbound, and a wider two-lane exit 18 ramp from I-91 southbound to I-691 westbound. Morgan said there is no date set for the beginning of Phase 3. Our project team is working with the Meriden community. They have an interest for us to come in and just give them an update about what to expect for construction. So that's going to be happening within the next month or two. We've already done public outreach and public info meetings, but they're going to get back out there before construction season gets in full swing. Morgan said it's true the construction slows down traffic and will for years to come. This is a seven-season construction project, many years, a lot of work, a lot of people who are going to be out there. So there will be lane closures. There's going to be detours, and I'm sure there's going to be some frustration on the part of commuters. Morgan asked for patience as the DOT makes investments in improving the roadways. You can't just shut down a major interchange that has 260,000 cars going through it every day to try to get the work done sooner. That would make people even more mad. Phase 1 total cost about $85 million. Phase 2, $220 million. And Phase 3 will cost about the same, although it's still in a design phase and has yet to be put out to bid. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on March 25th. It's written by Ed Stenard, and it's titled, Connecticut Bill Says Barber Cosmetology Schools Must Teach on Wavy, Curly, Coiled Hair. Barbers and owners of hair salons are cheering a bill that will require barber and cosmetology schools to train students in cutting and treating textured hair, such as black and Latina hair, that is coiled, curly, or wavy. Owners of cosmetology schools, however, say training and treating all kinds of hair is already in the curriculum and doesn't need a new law to mandate teaching it. In Connecticut, barbers and hairdressers are licensed by the Examining Board for Barbers, Hairdressers, and Cosmeticians. The bill, Senate Bill 178, has been passed by the Public Health Committee and now goes to the Florida General Assembly. It directs the Public Health Commissioner, consulting with the Examining Board for Barbers, Hairdressers, and Cosmeticians, to adopt regulations that would prescribe minimum curriculums to include working with various curl and wave patterns, hair strand thickness, and volumes of hair. I think it's about time, honestly, said Carmen Conway, owner of Brown Skin Woman, 942 Main Street in Hartford. Unfortunately, as someone who serves this population of hair and who identifies as well, we often go to salons to get our hair done, and they can't properly serve us because they were not trained on the cosmetology level and haven't gone to cosmetology school. Conway said the school she went to no longer exists. She said she learned to treat textured hair in Washington, D.C. I offer training where I train professionals on working with tight curls. And unfortunately, the narrative and the curriculum have been the same for these people around the world, not just in the United States. They have to take some form of continuing education post-graduation to be able to serve tight curls because they were not taught in cosmetology school. Whether someone has straight hair, wavy hair, loose curls, or tight curls, they still need the same things. You just style them a little differently to bring out the best in the curl or the wave. From a style perspective, I would reach for different tools and different products. So I'm going to look for the type of product or two that's going to enhance the curl that they already have. That could be a form of gel or a styling mousse. For really curly hair, I would use a tool other than a hairdryer. I work with curls exclusively, Conway said. I have a small amount of white clients because they can go anywhere that serves curls, but tight, curly clients need the difference in the type of products and techniques, and so they'll come to me primarily. I have mostly, I would say, 90% black women. It's unfortunate that it hasn't already been included because when you study the art of hair, you should learn about hair, said Liebert Lester Jr., owner of It's a G-Thang, 2404 Main Street, Hartford, which caters to black men. I went to Prince Tech High School and there was nothing in the curriculum about my hair type, said Lester, who is black. I came home and I practiced on my brothers, guys in the neighborhood. My teacher was a phenomenal teacher, Italian guy. He did the best with what he knew. He didn't know how to cut my hair, so he didn't teach it, but he taught us the art of barbering. Joy Martin of Head to Toe Saloon, 2087 Main Street in Hartford, said she learned about cutting and treating all textures when she went to school in the 90s. My experience was that we did learn, she said. Hair was hair. There's a different type of texture of hair, and we learned about all different types of texture of hair. There was no one specific type of hair that we learned about. We learned about hair in general, all textures. Owners of cosmetology schools said the standard curriculum published by Malati includes textured hair, though it's unclear if every school uses it. We have always trained all hair types, so this is not going to change anything for our school in particular, said Kelly Steves, owner of the Oxford Academy of Hair Design in Seymour, a school that has a salon open to the public. That's just part of the curriculum, to teach all hair types, she said. I will say in the last few years that Malati, which is what 90% of the schools use for education, had implemented more curriculum and videos, and they're the ones that they provide the textbook that 90% of schools use and lesson plans and procedures. Sleeve said Malati added much more information in its curriculum on textured hair about 3 years ago. I just think it's great that they're implementing this and having that diversity and inclusiveness in schools. I think that there is definitely growth that can happen in schools by implementing more texture services and training for the students. While Oxford Academy is located in Seymour, and I don't know what the exact demographics are, we have all types of braiding, we do straightening, we do all those types of services. So I don't really think it's going to change much as the operations of the schools. I don't know why people are making such a big deal about this, said Michael Cervellino, owner of the Bell Academy of Hair Design in Waterbury. He said he thought the bill was suggested by someone who wasn't taught at their school and pushed it by a company that sells products for textured hair. We already teach this in the books, Cervellino said. It's there, textured hair and curly, wavy hair. We're in Waterbury, so some of the students are black, so we're about 45% ethnic school. We do box braiding, cornrows, and we do tie-ins. You can look up the Malati book. The 14th edition has ethnic hair, wavy hair. Look at up a Tina mannequin. A Tina mannequin is black. Is a black mannequin. They get four mannequins when they come to school here, so I don't know where all this stuff is coming from, but it's just not true. Our next article was published in the Hartford Courant on March 25th. It's written by Allison Cross, and it's titled, Bid to Expand Paid Sick Days to All Connecticut Workers Advances. To expand paid sick leave to all workers in the state will advance to the House and Senate after passing out of the Connecticut General Assembly Labor Committee. Vilified by small business backers and celebrated by labor advocates, three separate proposals to extend the benefits in Connecticut's sick day law for small business employees passed 8-4 in votes that fell on party lines. Under statutes passed in 2011, businesses with 50 or more employees must provide paid sick time to their workers. The bills advanced Thursday would close this gap, mandating that all employers, aside from those participants in certain multi-employer health plans, offer each employee at least 40 hours of annual paid sick leave. According to estimates shared by the Connecticut Senate Democrats, the expansion could benefit as many as 1.6 people in the state. The issue of paid sick days quickly emerged as a priority for Democratic leaders in the state. At the start of the session, Governor Ned Lamont introduced Senate Bill 12. Democrats in both chambers later introduced their own proposals with Senate Bill 7 and House Bill 5005. After the committee moved forward with all three bills, Senate Republican leader Stephen Harding and Senator Rob Sampson, a ranking member of the committee, said the affirmative votes from Democrats added to the Connecticut's reputation of being a bad state for business. The tone-deaf proposal will hurt employers and employees by eliminating their ability to negotiate employment terms themselves. It will make a business reticent to choose Connecticut as a place to operate. It will raise costs for consumers. It also reveals how out of touch majority Democrats are. Big government telling mom and pop shops what they must do and forcing them to comply is their priority. Ranking member Representative Steve Ware agreed, calling the proposed mandates extremely disturbing. As a small business owner, I know firsthand how difficult these added costs and regulations make owning or operating a company. Ware said in a statement on Tuesday, I have serious concerns about the financial impact mandating paid sick days will place onto some of our smallest employers. Despite its support by the governor and labor committee majority, these policies will only further move Connecticut behind the rest of the country when it comes to economic growth and business friendliness. Proponents of the legislation argue that guaranteed sick days could help the economy by attracting and retaining young workers who find such policies attractive. In the days leading up to the vote, Lamont met with committee leaders to urge lawmakers to approve his proposal. If there's anything we have learned from the recent outbreak of a viral pandemic, it's that illness can spread quickly, and workers are sometimes left in a situation in which they have to choose between going to the workplace sick and risk spreading that illness to their coworkers and clients, or sacrificing a day's wage and be unable to support themselves and their families. If the expansion passes, Connecticut would join Arizona, California, Illinois, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Jersey, Vermont, Washington, and Washington, D.C. on the list of U.S. states and territories that mandate employers with one or more workers to offer paid sick leave. At a press conference on Tuesday, Committee Chair Senator Julie Kushner said that the Connecticut Family Medical Leave Act applies to serious illnesses and does not cover mild sickness that may cause an employee to be out of work for a day or two. She said paid sick days will help workers fill that hole when they get a loved one sick. It's bad public policy to put workers in a situation where they have to choose between paying their rent and staying home with a sick child. We're going to fix it that session. I feel pretty confident. Kushner said she believes the small businesses will remain resilient despite the new mandate. Every time we enact progressive legislation that helps workers, there's always a concern that it will damage small businesses. We've heard that in the minimum wage discussions we've had in the past, and what we see is that small businesses can and do survive and thrive when we improve the conditions for workers, and I think that will be true for paid sick days. According to Kushner, Lamont's proposal and the Senate priority bill are nearly identical. Kushner said that under both bills, employers must comply with the legislation by October 1st, 2024. Each employee will accrue 1 hour of paid sick leave for every 30 hours worked. New employees may tap into the accrued sick time after 100 calendar days on the job. Unused sick time can roll over into the following year. However, Kushner said employers may limit an employee's available sick time to 40 paid hours annually. Kushner explained that House Bill 5005 would implement a staggered three-year rollout of the requirements. Employers with 25 or more employees must offer sick time by January 1st, 2025. Employers with 11 or more employees by January 2026. And the phase-in for all remaining employers will take effect on January 2027. Through the House proposal, employees become automatically entitled to 40 paid hours of sick time at the start of each calendar year. New employees must work for a total of 180 days to qualify for the full 40 hours. Our next article was posted to the Town of Fairfield online service on March 26. It's written by Jared Wardwell, and it's titled, Fairfield Will Go to Court to Block UI Monopole Plan. The local property owners in Fairfield will lose more land than initially expected under United Illuminating, or UI's, plan to build steel monopoles through the town as part of the major utility line upgrade. The amount of private property UI can use in Fairfield is set to increase from less than 9 acres to nearly 11 acres as the result of a Connecticut Siting Council decision last month to move the proposed monopoles, which will carry transmission lines along the railroad tracks from the south to the north of the tracks, according to the council filings. UI had applied to use 19 and a quarter acres of private property across Fairfield and Bridgeport for the project, but the Siting Council's decision had not specified that relocating the monopoles north would increase that number to 22 acres, which UI officials confirmed to Hearst Connecticut Media was their current total estimate. The Siting Council is the state panel that regulates utility projects. Oh my dear Lord, said Fairfield First Selectman Bill Gerber, who was unaware of the increase in private property acreage until recently and asked for comment. Gerber said the town plans to file an appeal against the project in Superior Court soon. He hopes the legal action from the town will mean a stay from this court, pausing UI's construction until a judge makes a ruling on the project's legality. UI officials said construction is set to begin between 2025 and 2026, and the revised plans would likely jack up the project's cost from $225 million to an estimated $322 million. Gerber said he viewed the Siting Council decision as a potential step in the right direction last month, but said the lack of communication about the added impact to private property did a disservice to the public. It's embarrassing. I don't know if it's embarrassing for me or for them, he said of UI. If they had this information, it's another example of them not being transparent. That's really, really hard to understand why they wouldn't have made that clear. Neighbors, businesses, and elected officials have protested the construction plan for months. The plan to use private property for poles would provide UI with permanent access to homes, businesses, and place of worship and restrict the development of those properties. Cindy Bigelow, president and CEO of Bigelow T, whose Fairfield headquarters border the railroad track, said officials with the T company are working to learn more about the monopoles, worried there might be a significant impact if any are put up on their property. She said she hasn't heard from UI about the plans and questioned if that means the Bigelow property would dodge the direct effects of the project. I realize those poles could be impacting a lot of residents and businesses. I'm concerned for all those affected. Gerber said UI and his administration had not spoken about the alternative plan to move the monopoles north until earlier this month when they met for a tour of the targeted properties north of the railroad tracks. UI officials said they had sent a letter last month to their resident and business customers who either are near the rail tracks or sit within the project's direct visual line. The letter explained the engineering, energy, land management, community outreach, and environmental and permitting work the company plans over the next year or two. Liz O'Connell, a business manager at Highland Imports on Linwood Avenue, which sits across the street from the railroad tracks, said earlier this month that she hadn't received any kind of notice from UI about the monopoles. She said she was worried about traffic interruptions from construction near her business, which sits between Post Road and Interstate 95. It's difficult for the truck drivers to even back into our loading dock as it is right now, so if these poles are going to be some massive obstacle, that's going to be a problem. The monopoles relocated to the north would extend from the project's western border near Sasco Creek to the Ash Creek substation, which sits across from the Fairfield Metro Station in Bridgeport's Black Rock neighborhood. Moving those monopoles north would increase the total area of private property easements in Fairfield, which give UI the legal right to use residence land. UI applied to use 5.9 acres of private property between those two points, but that number will jump to 8 acres under the revised plans, according to the Siting Council. UI project manager Sean Crosby said the private property easements won't extend east of the Ash Creek substation, leaving Bridgeport virtually untouched by any further increase. Crosby also said UI plans to lower the monopoles by roughly 10% of their original proposed heights, which were set to range from 95 to 190 feet tall. He said lower monopole height likely means more monopoles to account for wire slack. Our job is to reduce impacts to customers and the environment and some of the things we look at. The Siting Council process surrounding the UI project has stirred debate in Hartford, where committees in the State Senate and House of Representatives consider bills that would reform the body's makeup. The Senate bill proposed neighborhood representation on the Siting Council. The House bill would bar more than one member with past or current investment or employment ties to utilities from serving on the board. Siting Council officials did not return multiple requests for comment. UI spokesperson Sarah Fleetosis stressed that current figures for the Fairfield project are estimates, not cemented calculations, as UI continues to craft a new project design that will balance its electric grid with the community it abuts. Modernizing the transmission infrastructure, not only in Fairfield County, but across our service territory, is essential for delivering reliable, resilient electric service now and well into the future, and UI is committed to working with all our stakeholders to ensure this obligation is met. Our next article was posted to the ct.insider.com service on March 26th. It's written by Jesse Leavenworth, and it's titled Federal Funds to Help Mystic Aquarium Conserve Endangered Species. From developing penguin poop profiles to caring for cold-stunned sea turtles, Mystic Aquarium's ongoing efforts to save endangered species received a boost recently with a $2 million grant in federal funding. The money is meant to bolster the nonprofit organization's work to conserve federally protected species such as African penguins, Kemp's Ridley sea turtles, North Atlantic right whales, walruses, and beluga whales. Scientists believe that we are in the midst of what is being called the sixth mass extinction event, with one quarter of marine mammals, one half of penguins, and virtually all species of sea turtles threatened with extinction, Katie Kubina, the aquarium's senior vice president for mission programs, said. Non-intrusive approaches are necessary when studying federally protected species in the wild. More often than not, it's a hands-off policy. The penguin guano profiles are a case in point. African penguin populations have plummeted to just 2% of its historical numbers due mainly to climate change, overfishing, and pollution. The aquarium's research team recently created a method of analyzing the birds' droppings to learn about their diet, immune health, and reproductive status while avoiding the need for direct handling. For over two decades, Mystic's animal care team has traveled to South Africa to work with the Southern African Foundation for the Conservation of Coastal Birds to help care for the orphan penguin chicks and respond to oil spill disasters. Now, the aquarium research and education team will join the effort, conducting vital health assessment work in South Africa and documenting the plight of African penguins and the important restoration work needed to save the species from extinction. The team will make the trip later this year or in 2025. The nonprofit aquarium also highlighted ongoing efforts to rescue and rehabilitate threatened and endangered sea turtles and return them to warm water homes. Each year, about a dozen critically endangered Kemp's Ridley sea turtles are brought to the aquarium for several months of rehabilitation after being found cold-shocked on Cape Cod. Currently, 12 turtles are in care and are likely to be released into more hospital waters in the near future. The Kemp's Ridley is the smallest and most endangered of the world's sea turtles. They are famous in the Gulf of Mexico, where they gather in thousands to lay eggs in mass on the same stretches of beach. The federal funding also is to be used for ongoing efforts to help the Cook Inlet beluga whale population in Alaska, along with right whales and walruses. Distributed through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the money also will enable Mystic to reach out to 800,000 annual visitors about endangered species conservation and expand its education, citizen science, and community engagement programs, which reach more than 100,000 youth and educators annually. The urgency around saving African penguins, sea turtles, and whales from extinction has never been greater. Mystic Aquarium is excited to bring together its scientific, animal care, and education teams to work with partners across the globe to help save endangered species. Our next article was posted to the City of Hartford online service on March 26. It's written by Emily DeSalvo, and it's titled, "There are 400 homeless students in Hartford schools, but still remain a problem. Taking the bus home, doing homework, and getting dressed for school can be challenging tasks for the hundreds of students in Hartford who are homeless. In numbers shared with the Hartford City Council, the district reported that approximately 400 homeless students are enrolled in school this year, much higher than the preliminary state estimates for the 23-24 school year, which estimated approximately 200 Hartford school students would be homeless that year. Getting to school is the first barrier that many of them face," said Stacy Cote, deputy director at the Center for Children's Advocacy, a nonprofit based in Hartford. "And so then, when you're not getting to school and you've missed days of school, obviously you're missing lessons and you're missing the ability to engage with the academic material." A conversation with one family made Councilwoman Mally Rosado realize she, along with many parents, know little about the rights afforded to these students. Rosado spoke with a mother who sleeps in her car with her kids and later contacted Superintendent Leslie Torres Rodriguez about the situation. Torres Rodriguez pointed her to the McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act. "The mom did not know anything about McKinney-Vento," Rosado said. "I'm saying, what is the disconnect between the schools and the parents?" Rosado said she too had never heard of the legislation, which mandates every district appoint a liaison to help students experiencing homelessness and ensures educational stability for those children. She penned a resolution for the City Council meeting on Monday, asking Torres Rodriguez to come to a meeting and raise awareness about the city's homeless student population. The resolution is co-sponsored by Councilman John Gale, who said he doesn't know much about the topic but doesn't think efforts to tackle housing issues in the city can happen in a vacuum without looping in the school district. "We're probably more in the information gathering stage here," Gale said. "Then we can sit down and see what we have available for attempting to solve homelessness in Hartford." Rosado said she would like to do a campaign of sorts to raise awareness about the problem and to eliminate shame among parents, and hopes she can connect them to a district liaison and resources. The data provided to the council from the district shows 255 of the approximately 400 homeless students in Hartford are Hispanic, and many are currently eligible for free meals. The state tracks homelessness by district through the data platform EdSite. Hartford is on the top 5 districts for homelessness, below New Haven, Waterbury, and New London. Statewide, about 5,000 students experience homelessness. The number of students experiencing homelessness in Hartford has increased since the 2020 school year, reaching a high point of 434 students last school year. This year's numbers are still preliminary, but appear to reflect a decrease from last year. Cote said that these numbers are under counts because a lot of students keep the information private. She also said it's important for districts to cross-reference this data with the rate of chronic absenteeism, which is 46% in Hartford. One leads to the other. The state data breaks down the percentages of students who live in hotels, shelters with other families, and those completely unaccompanied, but does not show the number on the district level. Cote said the unaccompanied number is particularly important. "It's minors and students who are young adults, high school up through 21, who are not in the physical custody of a parent." Jess Sugarman, a spokesperson person for the district, says the superintendent welcomes the opportunity to speak before the council. He directed families to the district's Welcome Center, which has resources for homeless families. It's just a trickle effect on children where they shouldn't be worrying about these things, Rosado said. Our next article was posted to the ctinsider.com online service on March 26. It's written by Alex Puderman, and it's titled, Neighboring Connecticut School Districts Have Some of the Nation's Starkest Inequalities. Connecticut is home to some of the nation's starkest inequality between neighboring school districts, according to new data. As part of a project examining disparities in education, the Washington, D.C.-based think tank New America analyzed thousands of adjacent school systems across the United States, comparing the median household income of one district against the other. By this measure, previously unpublished data shows that Connecticut is home to 23 of the top 300 most unequal borders in the country, including 8 of the top 100. In most cases, these borders are between the state's largest cities and their suburbs, though in some instances, the disadvantaged district is a small city or suburb. The border between Hartford and South Windsor represents the starkest disparity, followed by Hartford and West Hartford, Bridgeport and Fairfield, Bridgeport and Trumbull, and Waterbury and Cheshire. Only three states have more entries on the top 100 than Connecticut, and all three, California, Ohio, and New Jersey, have much larger populations. Zahava Stadler, project director for the New America's Education Funding Equity Initiative, attributed Connecticut's prominence on the list to the state's high level of inequality, as well as its tightly drawn town borders and municipally run school systems. It's absolutely notable that a state of the size of Connecticut has so many of the 100 most segregating borders by this metric. And it tells us two things. One, there's a lot of inequality in the state. And two, Connecticut has altogether too many school districts. Whereas in some places, diverse municipalities share resources under regional or county school systems, Connecticut districts are typically defined by municipal borders, leaving poorer communities separated from wealthier communities. Disparities between neighboring districts directly affect students, limiting opportunities for those in poorer communities. Data from the Hartford-based School and State Finance Project shows that Connecticut's poorest cities often spend far less per pupil on education than their wealthier neighbors, despite receiving significant state and federal aid. New America collected data on income disparities among neighboring school districts as part of a national report on the subject, which cites Connecticut as being home to some particularly stark divides. What we were looking at is, where do borders most powerfully separate kids from resources and from each other? In Connecticut and elsewhere, these socioeconomic gaps correlate closely with racial disparities, the report notes, with heavily Black and Latino districts often poorer than majority white districts. Though the New America report mostly considers the problem through comparing poverty rates in neighboring communities, researchers also collected data based on median household income, which they shared with CT Insider. Stadler said analysts, based on the median household income, more effectively conveys disparities in Connecticut and other wealthy states. Jordan Abbott, a data analyst who co-wrote the New America report with Stadler, called Connecticut a really clean and clear example of how district borders drive segregation. Districts have been drawn among municipal lines so that only further isolates these communities and shunts them into very small, narrowly defined schools. Under a century-old state law, Connecticut school districts are defined by municipal borders, with local boards of education retaining full control over school districts in their towns. Towns can choose to form regional districts, but do so only rarely and almost never with neighboring districts with drastically different racial or socioeconomic profiles. For years, advocates have advocated a more regional approach as a way of improving racial integration and economic equality. In 1996, a judge in the landmark Sheff versus O'Neill integration case called the law granting local control over education the single most important factor contributing to the present concentration of racial and ethnic minorities in Hartford schools. Regionalization proposals, however, often face opposition from officials and residents of smaller suburban and rural towns who value local control and aren't anxious to share resources with neighbors. While there is currently no serious legislative push for a more regional approach to education, lawmakers continue to debate school funding levels with an eye toward helping reducing disparities between the state's wealthier districts and its poorest ones. Last year, legislators and Governor Ned Lamont agreed to an additional $150 million for K-12 education, much of which was earmarked for poor urban districts. This year, Lamont has proposed redirecting some of that money to other areas of the state budget, while Democrats in the legislature have promised to preserve the committed funds. The issue will be resolved in the coming weeks as lawmakers negotiate a final budget for the coming fiscal year. According to the New America's report, the school district border with the nation's greatest socioeconomic disparities between East Orange and Glen Ridge, New Jersey. The border between Dallas and Highland Park, Texas is next, followed by the border between Warrensville and Orange City, Ohio. Connecticut's most unequal border between Hartford and South Windsor ranks 14th, according to New Markets analysis, with South Windsor's median household income more than three times that of Hartford. Our next article was published in the Meriden Record Journal on March 26. It's written by Law Guzman, and it's titled, Beat the Street Launches Live Sound Engineering Program in Meriden. The Beat the Street Community Center is launching a new program designed to introduce teenagers and young adults to the world of live sound engineering. The program is aimed at those who may not have had the opportunity to learn about sound engineering in a formal setting and give them hands-on experience by helping with sound for community events. We want to just expose people who wouldn't be exposed and in a more formal educational setting, said live sound director Ethan DuPont. It's not something that you're really learning about in a formal educational setting, so being able to provide that sort of education in a low-pressure environment or low-stakes environment where you're not being tested on your skills, you're not being graded. DuPont is aiming to find about 15 students for a program that will run for 6 to 8 weeks. He explained that students will learn how to operate both large and small format sound mixing consoles and how to adapt their approach to different types of venues and audiences. DuPont has been playing the bass guitar since grade school, but got his start in what he called the audio world in 2017 when he started wrapping cables and learning how to do live audio. He graduated with a bachelor's degree in audio and music production from Western Connecticut State University in 2023 and has worked with both tours and studios. Now he said he is excited to share his knowledge with students. It is more than just setting up speakers, making sure that someone whose voice is being heard and sitting down and letting it be. It's more than that. It's an interactive experience. If it's bad, they're going to remember. But if it's great, they're going to have a lasting memory. Executive Director Larry Pelletier explained that Beat the Street was able to purchase the sound equipment with a grant from the Kuno Foundation and that the education program is funded with grants to the Napier Foundation and United Way. In addition to classroom instruction, Pelletier said the program will also provide students with the opportunity to gain practical experience and explore a career in sound engineering while working at local community events and serving the broader nonprofit community. Since renting sound equipment can be costly, he said he is also looking to train a group of young people who know how to work with the equipment safely so that they can partner with other nonprofits to provide sound at their events, including fundraisers and showcases. You have a willingness to support their venues because a lot of these other nonprofits, different civic groups have supported us over the years. So this is an opportunity to support and give back. The program appears to be generating interest from parents as well. Diana Hatcher, who brought her son to the program's open house, is encouraging him to enroll. He's in a drama club. They have him doing lighting. If you learn sound, that's more to your resume, said Hatcher. Classes begin on Tuesday, March 19th. If you are more interested, contact the Beat the Street Community Center at 203-686-1639. Our next article was published in the Associated Press online service on March 25th. It's written by Fatima Hussein, and it's titled, The IRS has 940,000 unclaimed tax refunds from 2020 that are about to expire. The IRS is warning taxpayers that they may be leaving more than $1 billion on the table. The federal tax collector said Monday that roughly 940,000 people in the United States have until May 17th to submit tax returns for unclaimed refunds for tax year 2020, which total more than $1 billion nationwide. The average medium refund is $932 for 2020. Texas has 93,000, California 88,000, Florida 53,000, and New York 51,000. These are the largest amounts of people potentially eligible to receive these refunds. IRS Commissioner Danny Werfel said in a statement, "We want taxpayers to claim these refunds, but time is running out for people who may have overlooked or forgotten about these refunds. There's a May 17th deadline to file these returns, so taxpayers should start soon to make sure they don't miss out. For people who need to file a return, the IRS advises taxpayers to request their W-2, 1098, 1099, or 5498 forms from their employers or their banks. Taxpayers typically have 3 years to file and can claim tax refunds, otherwise the money becomes the property of the U.S. Treasury. Generally, the deadline to claim all refunds falls around April 15th tax deadline, but this year, the three-year window for 2020 unfiled returns was postponed to May 17th because of the COVID-19 pandemic. But if taxpayers haven't filed a return for tax year 21, 22, and any 20 refunds would be withheld until they file for those years as well to make sure they don't owe. Werfel said some people may not realize that they may be owed a refund. We encourage people to review their files and start gathering records now so they don't run the risk of missing the May deadline. Tax season officially began on January 29th. According to the latest tax season statistics, more than 71 million individual tax filings have been submitted to the IRS thus far this year. Our next article was posted to the CT.insider online service on March 27th. It's written by Jesse Leavenworth, and it's titled, "Study Finds Lyme Disease Carrying Deer Ticks Often Infest Connecticut Stone Walls." Ticks that spread Lyme disease teem on the edges of backyards and along Connecticut's ubiquitous stone walls, according to a new study by Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station scientists. Backyards continue to be high use and subsequently high exposure risk areas for the public, authors Megan A. Linsky and Scott C. Williams wrote in the study focused on deer ticks. Gaining a better understanding of the variability in tick densities in these areas can not only increase awareness for homeowners, but also produce more informed and lower volume pesticide applications, as well as landscaping or vegetation management. Published February 20th in Environmental Entomology, the study by the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station researchers was done on 42 residential properties in Guilford, where ticks were collected from May to July 2022. Guilford was chosen in part because Lyme disease is endemic in the shoreline town, according to the authors. First identified in old Lyme in 1975, the disease is still significant throughout the state and the most prevalent tick-borne infection in the U.S. About 476,000 people are treated for Lyme disease annually, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, but only about 35,000 cases are reported each year, in part due to diagnostic errors and unnoticed infections. If left untreated by antibiotics, it can cause chronic neurological, cardiac, or arthritic symptoms, sometimes lasting for years. About 30% of ticks in Connecticut are infected with the bacterial cause of Lyme disease. About 6% of ticks in the state also carry another pathogen. Linsky and Williams found ticks were three times as dense along stone walls compared with areas without walls. They also found that wood piles were not heavily infested, likely because wood piles are not permanent, while stone walls have crisscrossed the state for decades and in some cases centuries. Ticks were most abundant in the meter-wide strip where maintained yards met woods, according to the study. White-tailed deer and white-footed mice, host to the Lyme-causing ticks, frequent these areas, and mice also live and breed in stone wall access. Deer and other wildlife hosts use these forested interior habitats as travel corridors between properties for safety during much of the day and as conduits to exploit the maintained landscape during their peak crepuscular dawn and dusk activity periods. The authors also found that wood chip barriers along lawn edges likely have minimal impact on deer ticks, but the presence of a wood chip barrier may provide a visual reminder for homeowners that the ideal tick habitat lies just behind. Warmer, wetter seasons are conducive to deer tick proliferation, but the researchers cautioned that other species of disease-carrying ticks found in Connecticut, including the Asian longhorn and Lone Star species, persist in a variety of habitats and do not need the human environment necessary for the deer tick. Asian longhorn ticks are potential vectors of disease for both livestock and humans. In Asia, these ticks spread several different diseases, including a viral hemorrhagic fever and Japanese spotted fever, two serious diseases that can be fatal. Another study found that Asian longhorn ticks can carry and spread Rocky Mountain spotted fever in laboratory conditions. The study on backward ticks was funded mostly by a contract with the CDC and also by the State General Fund and the U.S. Department of Agricultural National Institute of Food and Agriculture. Our next article was published in the Hartford Courant on March 27th. It's written by Don Stakem, and it's titled, Connecticut Town Seeking Developer to Transfer Old Mill into Workforce Housing. As part of what it calls the Riverside Revival, Bristol is offering to sell the 80,000-square-foot former J.H. Sessions & Son factory for $1 to a qualified developer ready to convert it to modern income apartments. City officials are hoping that a new owner is in place by the end of the summer and that a complete renovation of our four-story brick building could be completed within 2 to 3 years. Several dozen developers and builders toured the property last week at a meeting where city officials fielded questions about its condition and what Bristol wants from its development. The city will accept bids from companies through April 16th. At our pre-bid meeting, we had around 40 people sign in, a lot more than we expected. There were local developers and people from Atlanta, Boston, New York, and New Jersey who specialize in mill redevelopments, according to Mayor Jeff Caggiano. It shows the excitement about what's happening downtown, Caggiano said. We want someone who has a lot of vision for that building. 3 years ago, the state provided a $2 million grant that Bristol is using for environmental cleanup of the 118-year-old building and surrounding 3.5 acres. The last hazardous materials should be off the site in June. The J.H. Sessions & Son Company once manufactured luggage, hardware, locks, hinges, and other metal products in the factory along Riverside Avenue, but gradually cut back operations in the 60s and 70s before closing altogether in the mid-80s. It has loomed over Riverside ever since, occasionally hosting a handful of tiny businesses, but has remained empty. Governor Ned Lamont visited the city in 2021 to announce the Brownfields Grant, which was supposed to be the first part of the plan for the Bristol Housing Authority and Vesta Corporation to jointly develop workforce housing there. But Vesta dropped out after it couldn't arrange sufficient financing, and the city is now looking for a new developer. The city intends to transition this environmentally remediated property from an abandoned mill building to a vibrant apartment community, the city said in its solicitation for bids. Bristol is leading the revitalization of Riverside Avenue Corridor in an effort known locally as the Riverside Revival. Riverside Avenue runs parallel with the popular Veterans Memorial Boulevard Park and is a key gateway to the city's re-engineered downtown. Bristol is undertaking a streetscape reconstruction for Riverside Avenue, which leads from Pine Street to North Main Street. In our best case, we'd have a developer in the late summer or fall, and they'd complete this in late 26 or 27, according to Mayor Caggiano. That's all for this week's Connecticut Connections. If you have any questions about this or other programs on CRIS, please call the CRIS listener line at 860-727-9579. This is Peter. So long till next time.